This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Heard any good commercials lately? Oh, wait, this is public radio. We don't have commercials. Well, there's a chance that you've listened to one of those other radio stations or watched TV or read a newspaper or been online or passed a billboard or walked into a store. Fact is, efforts to persuade us to buy a certain product, to act a certain way, vote for a particular candidate, efforts to persuade us are all around us. So how often do those efforts succeed? When do they fail? And why do they do either? In a week when we are asking you to help us keep non-commercial broadcasting alive, it seemed only fitting to also ask one of our favorite marketing analysts to come back and share her latest research. For even those of us who love public radio have to admit that we make decisions every day about what to buy and what not to. So Amanda Bauer has agreed to help us understand what goes into those decisions right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Okay, personal admission time. I was in kind of a girly store the other day. Now, I'm not going to give any hint of which store this was, other than to say it was not a lingerie shop. But it is a place where the number of women customers far outnumber men. I'd purchased a gift there for a friend a few days before using a gift debit card that I'd received myself from another friend many weeks before that. Problem was, the gift I'd purchased using that temporary debit card did not work out for my friend. She asked me to return it. And here's where it gets complicated. I no longer had the debit card I'd used for the purchase. The amount on it had been used up, so I'd thrown it away. The store said, since you don't have that temporary debit card anymore, we cannot give you your money back. I said, when you took the money out of that card, didn't you get cash? Yes, they said. But you can't accept this return and give me the cash back? Nope, they said. That's against store policy. You want to guess how often I'll be shopping at that store in the future? It turns out that a lot more goes into marketing than just the advertising we see on television. Product placement on store shelves, targeting which potential customers to send messages to and what kinds of messages and how to get them to them. And yes, store policies have a lot to do with how customers make decisions about what to buy, who to buy it from, and who not to buy from. Our guest this hour is a longtime researcher in such things, and I begin by telling you my somewhat embarrassing story. I mean, I probably really should have known better than to throw away that used-up gift card. Tell you this hoping it will encourage you to share some of your experience as a consumer. Is there a kind of marketing campaign or strategy that you'd be willing to admit has worked on you, or one that completely turned you off? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. Amanda Bauer has been studying what does and does not work in the world of marketing for the past two decades. Today, she's a professor of business and marketing at Washington and Lee University. Dr. Bauer, great to see you back in the Insight Studios.
Oh, thank you very much. I was really excited to be here until you said that two decades thing, and then I kind of winced a little bit.
Yeah, but you were really young when you started this.
I was like a fetus, yeah.
So when it comes, Amanda, to what makes American consumers tick, what works best with us, do we want a bargain? Do we want to feel like we're being treated fairly? Do we want to avoid any sense of regret? What's most important?
The sense that you are participating in a relationship. The sense that this is not a one-time thing. The sense that when you have bought that car or that non-lingerie gift, that that they don't just take your money and run away sort of laughing maniacally, right? That they're going to be... That this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship, that that I can trust you, that if something goes wrong with this, that I can come back to you and say something's gone wrong with this. And they shrug their shoulders and say, well, give it to me. And, you know, the sense that I can buy something and try something and have it work or have it not work, and then I can come back and buy something else and then buy something else. And it's not just about the buying, but it's also about the customer service. You know, I'm buying it and I'm trying to install it and I'm not sure and I can't figure out if what I bought from you is not working or if the thing I'm trying to install it into is not working. So getting a sense that they're with me, they're in it with me, they can help me, and then they'll be happy to see me come back. And realizing that any of the choices, you know, going back to your example, any of the choices that they make in this instance will have an effect subsequently. You know, it's one of the things that I think marketers do forget sometimes is that while in this particular instance, you know, once I bought the shoes or whatever, they're in charge of whether they get to take the return or not. What they're not in charge of is whether I come back. You know, I can go on one date with you and have it work really well and a great time. And I may go out with you again. But if I go out on a date and it's awful, don't call me back and say, hey, let's do, you know, 48th time's a charm. You know, at some point I'm going to break up with you. So, you know, it's and that's, you know, it's and we're seeing this increasingly, you know, in not just in the exchange relationship, but even in terms of social media, right? That it's something like 68% of people, some huge number of people expect if I tweet at a brand that the brand tweets back at me. Co-creation is becoming a huge thing that I can get on the internet and I can custom design what my thing is going to look like, what collar it's going to have, how long the, you know, the tail is going to be, how, you know, what the cuffs are going to be like. And so we're getting into that it's you and me together, as opposed to what I saw described recently was, as opposed to the old attitude of old school MBA, it's sort of us against the consumers. It needs to be more us with consumers.
Well, Dr. Barber, that sort of sums up the intriguing findings that in this study that's you've just completed, that just this month is being published in a major journal. Part of what's so surprising, you were looking at the behavior of online consumers and online retailers in a very specific type of instance, and the degree to which it was hard to persuade the retailers that they were doing something against their own interest. I want to get into that, but we're already getting some phone calls, so we'll get to at least one of these calls first, and then be sure to talk about this new study of yours with Dr. Amanda Bowers. If you want to talk to her, the phone number we're giving out right now is different than the one that you've been hearing all day. The 800 number that you've been hearing throughout the fund drive is to make a financial contribution. This 888 number is to make a talk contribution. And that number is 888-WMRA talk or 888-967-2825. From Harrisonburg, Jesse, thanks for using that number and calling in. Your question or comment for Amanda Bauer, please.
Well, you know, we were just talking off air a little bit about the marketing schemes that some companies use, and I think one company that is very good at marketing towards males is Omaha Steak. I was just in the thought process that they almost get me every time with this barrage of emails that the steak is 71% off, and it just looks perfect on this email, and it almost gets me nearly every time that they send it to me, and I don't know why. But it just, they do an exceptional marketing job, especially to males.
Do you grill?
Yes, I do grill. I wouldn't say I'm an avid griller, but you know, I bought typically once a year from Omaha Steak, but you know, about every month, every 2 months, you get this email, and I mean, I don't know what it is. I've had things in my shopping cart on the website before, and then said, wait a minute, what am I doing?
Okay.
And then go back. It's the craziest thing.
Well, what's interesting is that from an Omaha Steak perspective is the important word in everything you said so far is almost. So that's the important part. So, you know, I guess from an Omaha Steak perspective, the question is, you know, why do you, you know, these abandoned shopping carts, which is a pretty interesting problem. Of why do you, I guess the two questions. The first question is, what do you think is so tempting? Is it can't possibly just be the 71% off. There has to be something else. And then then the other part of that is, what stops you? Why do you go, what am I in, you know, why do you walk off from it?
Is the male thing? Because I'm hungry for steak just listening to Jesse talk about this.
Meanwhile, exactly. I just want another Diet Coke. So, yeah.
You know, I do think the advertisement does an exceptional job of saying, you know, if you just buy just this one thing, you're going to get six additional steaks. And, you know, you go on the website and suddenly before you know it, in your shopping cart, you have $200 worth of steaks that you recognize is going to take you 6 months to eat. So I think where they're missing the boat is, you know, they put an exceptional deal out, but once it's in your cart, it's not nearly as much of a deal. And I'm someone who suffers from buyer's remorse, so I'm very careful about finishing out purchases.
Yeah. Well, you know, and they would almost, you know, there are a couple things that are interesting about that approach. And this actually goes into this idea of what do marketers do sort of, what are things that marketers do that in the long run come back and sort of cause problems. And one of them is this idea of saying, you know, buy six, get six free, or, you know, what that does is that trains people in the long run that there's no way you would ever buy anything from that company without a deal. You know, that you're training, you're sort of Pavlovian dogging people. And you've seen that time and time again. Think about how people price airlines. You know, I mean, when people go buy an airline ticket, the first question is, how much does it cost? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the problems with this buy six, get six free kind of approach is that it gets big real fast, you know. So then the next thing you do is you look in your cart and you have $200 and you're going, whoa, I can't handle $200. It's almost like a steak of the month club maybe would be a better approach to something like that. But, you know, and that's something that marketers like to do. They like to offer deals, get people hooked on deals, and then consumers say, you know what? I'm not buying unless I get a deal. That's what caused GM a whole heap of trouble with their employing pricing. Because with employing pricing, they said, you know I don't ever have to pay full price for this thing. I'll just wait till it goes on sale again.
Jesse, thank you so very much for your call. Our guest on this edition of Virginia Insight, marketing researcher Amanda Bauer. Our call-in phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK. You can also reach us on Facebook, where we are listed as Virginia Insight. And this came in on Facebook from Jessica, who says, does it count as marketing when WMRA is trying to get me to call in and make a pledge?
Yeah, oh, yes. Absolutely. It definitely does. Marketing is, this is day one of marketing, but marketing is at its core the study of exchange. And, you know, marketing has very strong associations with sales and PR and branding and, you know, and some negative associations. But at its core, marketing is about exchange. And so marketing is about, I have something from you that I want, and you have, you know, we have something that we want to exchange. I've got something of value, you've got something of value, and how do we swap? And so, you know, what an NPR station is doing is saying, I'm providing you something of value, can you please support it? And then you try to sort of augment that with, I don't know, bumper stickers or, I don't know, tote bags or whatever Stephen Colbert jokes about.
See, I think, Amanda Bauer, that marketing has a lot to do with persuasion. And if that, in fact, is part of the criteria, then most NPR stations, including WMRA, are really bad at it. Because, you know, we have lots and lots and lots. The vast majority of people listening who've been listening for many, many years never make a contribution.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I don't know, if you had this nonprofit set up in your neighborhood that said, we want to feed people, so we're going to give you good food in a buffet that you can come in every day and take what you want. We just ask you to leave something at the door if you can. Mm-hmm. And for years and years, day in and day out, 80 or 90% of the people came in and never made a contribution. And it all depended on that 10 or 15% who did.
Right.
And I kind of think it's because those of us who work for nonprofits are just not very good at persuasion.
Well, you know, nonprofit is the hardest kind of marketing. And if you can do nonprofit marketing, I like to tell my students, you can do anything. It's the hardest thing. It's less obvious, I think, to the marketer what you're offering. You know, what is the specific thing that you're exchanging? And in the long run, you know, thinking about what really kind of clarifying and defining what it is that you need to communicate about your, I mean, let me put it this way. Under no circumstances should any NPR station feel like it's doing the worst nonprofit marketing out there. It's that awful Sarah McLachlan, Arms of the Angels. Oh, Lord, that that ad. I
wish people could see your face.
It's awful.
But we have to pause. Actually, so some of my friends can tell you the 800 number and try to persuade you to make a contribution, and then we'll be back. Well, thank you, Martha. And to you on the other side of your radio, marketing is our focus on this hour of Virginia Insight. What works, what doesn't. It is something not often discussed in nonprofit broadcasting, but this might be the right time to ask if you've ever made a contribution to a public radio fund drive like the one going on WMRA right now. What persuaded you to do so? On the other hand, if you, like many longtime listeners, have never been willing to help out, how come? We are not asking for your dollars at this moment, but your perspective. And the number for sharing that perspective is different than the one you just heard. It's not the 800 number for contributing dollars, although you're welcome to still use that. But if you want to contribute your voice, please call us at this 888 number, 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on Facebook at WMRA's Virginia Insight marketing research analyst and professor at Washington and Lee, Amanda Bauer, our guest. On the phone line with us from Standardsville is Lou. Lou, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Oh, well, first of all, kudos for getting me to hang on during the fundraising break.
Kudos for hanging on.
Different marketing.
I know you wanted to hang up and call back and use the 800 number.
Yeah, trapped audiences are never happy.
Well, I have kind of an experience that's the polar opposite of the one you had with the debit card. I am a big fan of Lowe's Home Improvement Warehouse because of their policy regarding returns and exchanges and things. I'm a do-it-yourself person, but I'm not always great at it the first time. And I tend to, you know, I might buy something that's the wrong size or whatever, and they just have a very, I guess, liberal is the way you would describe it, policy. As taking things back and allowing you to exchange things, and it's you know, perhaps some companies would look at it like it's costing them money to do that, but I think they look at it encourages people to continue to come in and to continue to patronize their store. And I'm like you, I find it very frustrating when I buy something and then I get the, well, I'm sorry, it's been 31 days or whatever the policy is, you can't bring it back anymore.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, Lou, this is why I'm sitting in the big comfy chair today, is because we did a study that wasn't studying that form of leniency of return policies, but we were studying a sort of form of leniency, which is looking at whether, or, you know, if you bought something from a catalog or an internet retailer, who pays for that return? And, you know, I think a lot of us, and I live in Lexington, which has, you know, it's a charming downtown, but if you want some good shoes, you're shopping online. And
so who pays for the shipping if you decide the shoes don't fit right?
If the shoes don't fit, who pays for the return shipping? And we've all had that experience where you buy the thing and it comes, and then there's that return label, right? And you take the return label off and you stick it on there, and it says $6.95 will be deducted from your reimbursement for returning this product. And so what we did was we said, because my experience with it was actually similar to your sort of a combo platter of yours and Lou's experience, which was I remember getting ready to return a package to a company that I had figured out their return shipping policy, which was if you bought something and you returned it and you just were returning it, you had to pay that $6.95. If you were exchanging it, they would pay for your return shipping. So I would game the system, right? I would say, you know, just like the thing I was saying before about you make it six, you know, buy six, get six free. Guess what I'm doing? You know, I'm waiting until I get six free. So it's the same thing. I said, well, I'll just buy three things knowing there's something else I'm going to want to buy. And then when something doesn't fit, I'll ship it back and get something else. Well, so this company said, we're changing that. We're not doing it anymore. From now on, you have to pay for all your returns, regardless of whether you're exchanging or not. And I instantly broke up with the company, told them to, you know, in my head, arguing with a cardboard box in my bedroom. Told him to get stuffed. And then I had this epiphany of, you know, this is a big deal. You know, this goes back to the original idea in this whole talk today of they just ruined a perfectly good relationship over $7. And you might make the argument that I ruined the relationship over the $7, but I didn't see it that way. I'm a consumer. So anyway, so I started thinking about this idea of how important is the return policy? And at the time, there wasn't a whole lot of research in any kind of return policy, leniency of return policies. And then and anything you could really find at the time, which goes to Lou's thing about, you know, it's kind of makes sense that they would not want to have a lenient return policy because it costs them money. And you would see from, like, economists that would say, if, you know, consumers are a rational consumer, which always kind of makes me giggle, but a rational consumer will see the return costs as a sunk cost, which basically means a consumer should disregard the cost because it's not relevant for future behavior. Well, I would argue it is relevant for future behavior because if you're buying shoes or clothes or, you know, like Blue's talking about, you know, he's not exactly sure if it'll fit or not, then it makes sense that I might have to return this. So you look at the return shipping policies of a lot of these online companies, and they are, if it's my fault, I'm the retailer, it's my fault, I'll pay for it. If it's broken, if I shipped you the wrong thing, the wrong size, the wrong color, I'll pay for it. If, on the other hand, it's not my fault, then it's your fault, Joe Consumer, and you get to pay for the return. And so what we did was we looked at whether you know, consumers make decisions that way. Do consumers say it's my fault or your fault? We looked at do consumers agree with the retailer's assessment? You know, whose fault is it if I get it and it's the wrong color? Is that my fault? Is it your fault? Is it just, you know, as Forrest Gump would say, it happens? Or and the third thing that I thought was really interesting that we wanted to explore was this question of is fairness the most important characteristic in a consumer's response? And what we found in all cases, which is I'll give you the quick answer, it's no, no, no. Consumers don't make it's my fault or your fault attributions. If I order it and it's the wrong color, it's nobody's fault. It just happens. Consumers don't agree with retailers' assessment of whose fault it is. And then the third thing is consumers, it does matter a little bit. It tweaks it up and down. But at the end of the day, the biggest thing that matters is not the extent to which you felt like having to pay for your, in this case, return shipping, whether that the fairness was not the issue. The issue is the regret over having to pay the $7 shipping. And or in this case, it was $15 and $24, depending on, because we had two different studies. So the regret, but it was also, oh, Lord, I don't want to have to buy something else from this company and then have to pay another $7 or $15 or $24 and be out $24 with nothing to show for it. And not only that, but if I bought $25 before and then I try again and now I have another $24 in the hole, I now out $48 and I have nothing to show for it.
But in terms of the retailer, mm-hmm. of the people who are making this marketing decision, maybe the thing that's going to speak loudest to them, Amanda Bauer, in your new study, is that you determined that the companies that did offer free return shipping, mm-hmm. so I, consumer, can buy from you online retailer with no danger.
Yeah.
If for whatever reason I decide that I don't want this or I need to return it, I'm not going to have to pay to return it. My loyalty to that company, my willingness to purchase from them in the future skyrocketed.
Yeah.
And in fact, the retailer was making a whole heck of a lot more money.
Yeah. If you required consumers to pay for their own return, sales sank post-return sales. So we had 2 years before the return and 2 years of sales after the return. So what we saw was sales would sink somewhere between, you know, 50, 75, but ultimately 100%. We watched people just, as my students would say, peace. We watched them take off. They were done. But if you give these free returns, we watched sales increase 50% all the way up to 3.5 times what their previous purchases were. We watched sales go from an average of, over the course of, you know, previous 2 years, an average of about $1,200 for the previous, each of the previous 2 years, to up to about $3,800.
Well, Lou, I'm with you. I know that whenever I'm going to make any kind of significant purchase of any kind, I'm always thinking ahead of time, if it can be purchased at several different stores, which store I'm going to choose is influenced by what my previous experience with their return policy is. So thank you so much for your call, Lou, and sharing your experience with us. Anybody else who wants to talk to marketing analyst and researcher Amanda Bauer, we've got a couple phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. Next call coming in from Charlottesville. This is Jordan. Jordan, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me. I think I heard you ask the question just to maybe provide an explanation for the NPR marketing and people not having the whole listener population provide or donate.
And actually, the fact that it's such a small percentage just makes me feel like a failure.
Well, I don't know if it's the correct economic term of just maybe positive or negative externalities, but it seems more just like a freeloading problem. And I have to admit that I think I'm a part of the problem. I've listened to this radio station for years and years and haven't made a donation. But the thing has been, it's just...
Good luck getting off the phone, by the way.
But it's almost like you know that the 10 or 15% of other people will chip in. And I think if we were to ever hear the message that, we're going to have to shut everything down, then everyone would chip in.
Yeah,
but I definitely will chip in this go round. I think it was more, I felt guilty about that once I heard it on the radio.
Well, Jordan, I appreciate that. And I just want to tell you that if everybody who was a regular listener to this radio station chipped in $10 or $15 a year, we would meet our budget. Because of the fact that it's only about 10% of the audience that feels that sort of responsibility and loyalty to actually pick up the phone and do that, we need much higher average contributions in order to survive. And I'll also tell you that the argument that there was a sea change in the Virginia General Assembly earlier this year when the Senate moved over to Republican from Democrat. So the fact that Republican conservatives for many years in the House had been saying, we really don't think that public broadcasting should be getting taxpayer dollars, finally won out over in the Senate when Republicans took over there. But many of them were regular NPR listeners. And they said, we enjoy the fact that you have balance, that it's not lots of yelling and screaming and unfounded accusations. But what we also know is that you have a large percentage of your audience who can afford to make a contribution, who never do. So why should taxpayers, even if these taxpayers are only paying 10 or 20 cents a year out of their total tax bill to go to your station, why should they have to pay anything when they're not listening and people who do listen don't make a contribution? And that's a little hard to argue with. And they eliminated the funding. So yeah, the fact that you're willing to call in and tell us about your experience and that maybe you are willing to chip in a little of what you can is very encouraging. I don't feel quite so much like a failure.
Glad I could help.
Well, you know, I mean, there is a huge challenge in nonprofit marketing. And part of the problem with generally speaking, not just about NPR stations, but generally speaking with nonprofit marketing is figuring out how to package what it is that you sell and not doing it in something that could only be described as sort of earnestness. Saying, you know, we're doing good, right? Because a lot of nonprofits do good. You know, we're helping animals, we're saving children, we're, you know, but if you compete on earnestness, you know, this idea of doing good in the world, then you have to still figure out, I mean, because I only have so much money, right? And I've got to figure out where's my money going to go. And if you're all competing on earnestness, or if you're doing sort of those low-hanging fruit things they try to do to heighten the value, or to use Jordan's word, guilt, you know, they do those things where they give you the pre-printed mailing labels, you know, with your name on it, part of which is misspelled.
I think we're talking about something different, though, that if you use the service, mm-hmm. if you are well off enough right. that you could certainly afford $10 or $20 or even $20 a month, but you decide that you're going to let somebody else pay for it right. for you, I'm not sure.
Well, the construct the label he's looking for is called social loafing, is what he's looking for. And so what he's describing
is... Well, repeat that. That's terrific.
Social loafing. And it is the reason when you go... He's laughing, by the way. Y'all should see him. It's the reason when you go out to eat, it's the reason why for tables of six or more, they go ahead and put the tip on top. Because once you start to reach a certain number, everybody starts to look around and says, when you start calculating what your how many appetizers you had or how many beers you had, it's been years since I've been in a situation where I could worry about appetizers and beers. But, that you start kind of your sense of responsibility dilutes. And so people tend to pitch in more. And so, so there's a responsibility on NPR's. Their shoulders to figure out how to, A, get people not to social loaf. I don't know how they – do you have a menu that you could say, a certain number of listeners and up, we'll go ahead and tip you to, put the tip on top. But that's the word that he's looking for, is social loafing, which is a huge challenge. Yeah.
Jordan, you've certainly gotten us thinking. Thank you so very much for your call. And the call-in number, which you're going to hear again in a couple of minutes if you want to make a contribution, is 800-NPR-WMRA. Please have a terrific day. Next to Mount Sydney, Susan, thanks for calling us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Amanda Bauer, please.
Hi. I have what is to me an amazing refund story. There's a company that is online, and they send probably two emails a day with different sales on all different stuff. It's, 35% off plus free shipping. The next one will be 40% off, but you pay for shipping, and it goes back and forth all day long. Anyway, I placed an order, and not even an hour after I had placed and paid for the order, I got a sale that would have saved me almost $40 on what I had just purchased. So I called them and said, and they immediately refunded my entire order and placed it again under the new sale.
And you're probably going to continue having...
Absolutely. I was amazed. Really was.
Well, and that was sort of the conclusion that we came with our paper as it suited into everything else, which is...
Hold on just a second for me. Susan, we have this 3-minute fundraising break coming up that is going to help us stay on the air if it's even marginally successful.
And I would say one more thing.
No, because we're going to hit the break here. The computer shuts us off. Could you hold on for three minutes?
I will.
We'll be back. Amanda Bauer is a professor of business and marketing at Washington and Lee University. Her areas of research have included corporate social responsibility campaigns, picture-based persuasion, and the use of beauty in marketing. She's also lead author of a new study examining how the cost of return shipping can influence consumer behavior when we are considering making purchases online. And we still have Susan on the line with us. She, by the way, reached us at our call-in phone number for talk as opposed to contributing dollars. For contributing talk, the phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK. And Susan, we were going to have Amanda respond to what you were saying, or did you have one more question you wanted to ask?
Well, actually, it was just a comment about the fundraising, because I've been listening to public radio, I don't want to say how many years, but all across the country in different states, and it's taken me a really long time to become a donator. And I think the key word is guilt. And you had run a spot with Alec Baldwin. It was incredibly satirical. I cannot remember exactly what he said, but it just...
He basically says...
It did it to me. I said,
don't contribute.
Time. That's it.
Make sure this radio station fails. Yes.
It was great. It was great. And I said, you know what? That's enough. I have to do my part.
Well, we'll have
to. You just need to come up with more guilt.
More guilt.
And you'll be good.
Mothers around, grandmothers around the world celebrate. I have
absolutely,
a job.
Absolutely. Because I wouldn't say, but it runs in my family. We know it well.
Susan, thank you so very much. We're going next to Rutgersville. This is Robert calling in on Virginia Insight. Robert, your question or comment for Dr. Bauer, please.
A couple of comments, and just want to let you know, thanks for taking the call. I live with somebody who is on fixed income, as am I. I'm on disability. So getting back to your Omaha Steaks thing,
uh-huh.
We buy once a year. We look at it as sort of our Christmas present to ourselves, and we probably spend $400 around Christmas.
Right.
We send to our relatives.
Right.
And that way they're getting presents all year long.
Right, yeah. Well, you know, and that's one of the things that marketers have to do is they have to figure out what is the role that I want my product to play in a consumer's life. And that's one of the things that does scare me a little bit about what Omaha Steaks is doing. I mean, aside from the consequence of teaching people that they can always get a deal on it. But the other thing of really thinking about, do you really, you know, does Omaha Steaks need to be like the every weekend kind of thing? Or does it need to be the treat, the special thing, the rewarding myself, the special thing? Because we've gotten from my husband's family, they've sent us Omaha Steaks before. And they are. They're neat, you know, they're all nice and wrapped and packaged. And my husband does grill. And so the idea of understanding the role that it plays and if it plays a significant, because it is, they're not cheap, you know, those are nice looking steaks. Yeah. So knowing that you and you feel good about having done that, you know, you feel good about this contribution that you're giving your friend or your family. And so, I mean, that's what, you know, companies like Omaha Steaks have to do. What's the other one? The fruit people that they make the fruit bouquets. Harry and David. Yeah. So my husband has done Harry and David. Thank you. Yes. My husband has done Harry and David for his grandmother, and he feels good about having done Harry and David. You know, I mean, you're not just sending your grandma pears from the Kroger. You're sending something special and meaningful. And that's what a brand really has to be very clear on, and not, you know, they have to think about the long-term consequences of the choices that they're making, and how they feel about their brand, and not just diluting their brand to the point where you feel like you're sending grandmother pears from Kroger.
And Omaha Steak is, like you say, it is a quality product. Yeah. And I also don't have to worry about, am I going to have to get it wrapped in time? Am I going to have to get it to the post office? Am I going to have to hope it gets there in one piece?
Okay, now you sound like my husband. I don't want to wrap it.
Robert, thank you so very much for your call. If there's anyone else listening who has any ideas about marketing or questions about that subject, and you'd like to talk with marketing researcher and professor of business and marketing at Washington and Lee, you can reach us at 888-967-2825 or on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we've got this on Facebook, Amanda, from Lawrence, who says, I almost never watch live TV anymore, so I race past most of the commercials on my DVR.
Mm-hmm.
But I admit I'll stop and go back when something catches my eye, including shots of beautiful women. Now, before I admit to being a male chauvinist, let me say that my girlfriend does the same thing. Are advertisers purposely sticking a lot more such visuals in commercials, hoping that we'll back up the tape and watch them? And is it true that such visuals are just as likely to catch a woman's eye as a man's?
Let me think. The first thing I should tell you is that the most recent statistic I saw was that 11% of people who watch TV no longer watch it live. They don't watch it ever live. They watch it on Hulu or their DVR or something like that. So you're definitely not alone. But again, that's the most recent number I've seen. So, you know, where that number is trending with everything else. In terms of there's another thing that they are learning with DVRs, and it started with VHS, was zipping versus zapping. And zapping is less of a possibility with DVR. Zapping is where you would, as you're recording your commercial, you would sort of hit pause or stop so it wouldn't record those things, and then you'd get back to recording. Zipping is what you're talking about, where you'd flip through it really quickly and you could see what it is. There's a great quote, I want to say it's Lee Cloud, but I can't remember. And it was, we pay attention to things that are of interest to us, and sometimes that's advertising. And so, you know, they have put things in there that are of interest. Now, it's maybe sort of hard to argue that finding an image of a beautiful woman on TV is rare. That's, you know, sort of this proliferation of these beautiful women on TV. Now, whether women pay more attention to women, I would say, you know, obviously, I mean, I don't think that, you know, the Kardashian show is full of just a male audience, beautiful being a somewhat flexible term. So whether males or females pay more attention to women, I mean, I would say that they do, you know, maybe for social reasons, possibly for evolutionary reasons, you know, assessing the competition and those kinds of things. It also depends on why your girlfriend stops to watch the thing, if she's interested in what the product is, whether the product is something that she feels like would enable her to do something, you know, I would like to hair my hair, have my hair shiny and sheeny and slick as that, or what. So, you know.
But you don't think that there are more beautiful women in television commercials or in more enticing.
As compared to.
For a few years ago before everybody's, well, lots more people started using DVRs.
No.
Okay.
No. There's a vast proliferation.
However, you have done research on beauty and marketing.
Yeah.
And basically, have you found that people will stop and pay more attention when there's a beautiful person to look at?
Fun fact, attention is only the first battle in advertising. I may pay attention, but there's a thing that people like to do where they watch a TV commercial, and then, and Super Bowl is a great example of this. So they watch TV and they say, oh, it's a good commercial, you know. And so what I like to do is let's go with a minute and a half, and then turn to them and say, what was it for? And if you can't remember what it was even for, that's pretty bad. If you remember what it was for product-wise, but not brand-wise, that's also kind of a problem. Because we understand from research that if you don't remember the brand, there's a chance that you will attribute it to the market leader. And if it was not an ad for the market leader, that's also kind of a problem. You have to figure out, you have to kind of treat marketing the way you give a dog a pill, which is you have to embed that pill in that hot dog so well that the dog can't eat the hot dog and not the pill. So you have to really kind of think about, how am I going to effectively embed into my advertising my brand and my message in a way that people are going to remember, and make it really very difficult for them to come away from that advertisement and not remember what it was for. So, you know, like Aflac Duck is great because you can't remember the punchline without remembering, you know, what it was for. So, you know, attention is sort of an easy low-hanging fruit. You know, let's go with the ads are louder when they come on. Yes, I'm looking up, but I'm not happy. You know, it's kind of like what I scream at my kids. Don't make me come in there. Yeah, I mean, and so attention is, you know, and of course the other way of looking at it is, you know, when your kids get quiet, that's when you should really worry. So, yeah.
Amanda Bauer says she was in her mid-teens when she started doing some work that led to her to question conventional assumptions about how to do marketing. She's been asking those types of questions for more than 20 years since,
yeah.
In addition to her current academic position at Washington and Lee, Dr. Bauer has also spent time in the business world with such companies as Frito-Lay and the international ad firm Gray Advertising. Amanda, we're going to run out of time soon, and it seems to me that there's one other key element that comes out in this new research that's just been published of yours, having to do with how consumers would act if they had this sense of, I cannot fail.
Right. Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
Well, you know, it goes back to how this whole conversation started. You know, what do consumers want? And consumers want to feel like they are part of a longstanding relationship. There's a, you know, I think it's the first season of Mad Men when Don Draper said something like, you know, consumers don't know what to think until I tell them. And that's done. That's over. That's gone. If you don't treat consumers in a sort of fair, equitable consumers' perceptions of equitable, not yours. Manner, you know, reliable, consistent, trustworthy manner, I'm going to leave because there's too many other possibilities out there. And so it really is, you know, that plaque that comes in sort of all these gift catalogs I get at Christmas time that you're supposed to give to inspire somebody about what would you do if you knew you could not fail. And when we were working on this paper, I thought, what would I buy if I knew I wouldn't have to pay for it? You know, what would I...
You wouldn't have to pay for to
the
return it
for the return.
If, in fact, it didn't work for
if
you.
If it didn't work. Or what would I buy if I knew that I could take it home and try it, and it, you know, it didn't work, and I could take it back, and I wouldn't be stuck with this thing? What would I buy if, you know, I knew that they had more reliable sizes? That, you know, because what you want to do as a marketer is you want to think about it from the consumer standpoint, which is every time a consumer enters into this relationship with you, they're putting things on the line. They're risking, you know, their time, their energy. I mean, even Zappos, which I love, but still, if it doesn't work.
Zappos is the online company.
Is the online shoe company, which is free shipping, free return shipping, and you can have it at your house for 365 days. That's not that 30-day thing. And what would I knew, you know, I can try things. And, you know, if anybody ever abused a return policy, it's me and Zappos. And yet they have just given me VIP status, which is slightly terrifying. I hope my husband's not listening right now. How many shoes have you bought? But it's fantastic, right? So I trust them now, and I know that I can enter freely and willingly into this relationship every single time.
So part of what we're getting to is, yeah, is the biggest mistake that marketers make is not thinking about how the consumer is going to view it. I mean, you talked early on, yeah, about this sense of fairness, and that was what the marketer's idea was.
Yeah.
It wasn't what the consumer's idea
was.
Right,
right. Well, and you have to think about, I mean, in every relationship that you're in, right? So, I mean, how many times have you been in an argument with your partner, spouse, girlfriend, boyfriend, where you say to them, you know, oh, yeah, you're right, I was totally wrong. You know, it never happens. So you have to think about, from your standpoint, there's the possibility that from their standpoint, you're completely wrong. And the thing is in the long run, that consumer is going to be the one who decides whether they come back or not. And so it is sort of this compendium of the marketer is looking at what's directly in front of them and thinking, you know, I don't want to lose this money, or I don't want to pay for this $7 return, or I, you know, what if this consumer is trying to game the system and take advantage of something. And it's not hard to figure out who those people are. You know, so if you do a return at Lowe's, I think without your credit card or the receipt, I think they use your driver's license, so they can figure out who you are. So it's not hard to identify those people, especially if you're doing something online. But, you know, just these small, you know, there's this cool, I don't know how much time we have, but there's this cool
30 seconds.
Well, it's been nice seeing you today. It's been lovely. Your Diet Cokes are tasty.
So the bottom line here is that from your perspective, uh-huh, marketing can do good,
yes,
especially if the marketer thinks in terms of the consumer's, mm-hmm, point of view of things.
I would say if you don't believe me, go to the Zappos website and read reviews of the shoes, and you will see that half the time the review is not of the shoes. It's a review of how much they love Zappos.
Our guest has been Amanda Bauer, professor of business administration and of marketing at Washington and Lee University. Her newest report was published in the Journal of Marketing. It examines what Dr. Bauer believes are erroneous assumptions that many online retailers make about the costs of return shipping and how free return shipping has led to lots of companies getting lots more business from return customers. Amanda, thanks so much. It was great to spend time with you
again. Thanks for having me.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.